So I am having such a great time going back both to memory lane when I learned the hermitory word aspects back in the 1980s at Dort College in Sioux Center, Iowa, and then having the privilege to be with Dr. Clauser, who actually studied with Dr. Hermann Doiweerd in the late 60s and early 70s, did his dissertation on Dr. Doiweerd. So we're talking about the aspects. And just to, this is part three, and let me just go over what we talked about. We talked about the quantitative, we talked about the spatial, the kinetic, the physical, the biotic, the sensory, the logical. And now we're launching into the next one, and I'm curious if you can guess what it is. Just make a guess. I like people just to try to think about it. Like if they think about logical, they're with part one and part two. Well, could it be the historical?
Well,
historical.
Special meaning to this. A lot of people think history means whatever happened in the past. The way Doiweerd points out does not. Most of what happened in the past we don't think is historically important.
Okay.
This has to do with the human ability to take a natural material and form something new.
Okay.
Which also means to take human beings and form something new.
Right.
Such as a business, a school, a state, and so on.
It's like the development of power, achievement, technology, technique.
So sometimes people have proposed this should really be called formative or technical. It has to do with bringing about artifacts.
Okay.
And what people sometimes fail to realize or think of very much is that human social communities are also artifacts. People form them.
Okay.
Yeah. So this has to do with the important formations that have taken place. History records the transmission of the power to form a culture, and culture is all the things that humans produce.
Right.
Make.
What you call the term historical also deserves some comment, though it is a familiar one. This is because so many people think of it as referring to everything that has happened in the past.
Doiweerd gives an interesting example. Historians actually debated whether part of the Battle of Waterloo that needed to be recorded was the farmers trying to harvest the crops that were in the way of the coming battle. They could see it, and they're trying to get the crops out of the way. Is that part of the battle? Is that historically important?
Right.
I think most people would agree, no. It was important to the farmers.
Right.
But as far as history is concerned, what's really important is who won the battle. It defeats Napoleon. It ends his empire. Europe is repartitioned out at the Congress of Vienna and all that. But not the farmers gathering their crops. But that happened.
Mm-hmm.
See, unless there's some criterion for what's important historically, you end up saying that everything is history, and then just writing history of anything takes as long to write it as it took to happen.
There's a popular video game that many of you have probably looked at or your children, if you have children, have played. It's called Civilization. And how Civilization works is that you start at like some place way in the distant future, and then it goes through these various civilizations, and each civilization has a unique contribution to culture. Like one culture figures out the technology of bronze, and another culture fireworks or gunpowder, I believe that was the Chinese. But anyway, so if the culture developed it, that particular strength would be accented more for their power and development. So it's almost as if Doiweerd was the creator of the video game, because he has that some. Would he be rolling over in his grave now?
Yes.
Okay. Next, let's just go to linguistics. So, the social or the symbolic communication, what's the linguistic aspect?
And do notice how there's an order to these, because intuitively I think everybody sees that you'd have to be able to form concepts in order to plan what to do with a natural material. You'd have to be able to form natural materials and have some experience with that, and then form sounds or marks that you make to symbolically stand for other things. Now we get a language. And then that's going to make human social relations possible, because humans are going to be able to communicate And as one writer pointed out, it's almost more important that humans were able to talk, to communicate to another human what they were thinking about and what they were feeling internally, mm-hmm. than more important than being able to have a symbol that points to something else.
Right.
That said, this is a tree and the brook is over here. That's important. But it's more important to be able to communicate plans, feelings, objections, recommendations. Then you have a real social bond.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, before we talked in the last session about active and passive, and in language itself, you have the active voice, the passive voice. Yeah. I mean, language itself is that way, where words can be acted upon or the word can act on someone. You know.
That active-passive distinction borrows this from language and applies it in other ways as well. So people have, and I made the point that many people think that logic only applies, the only things that have logical properties are propositions and arguments.
Right.
But no, if things have passive logical properties, then they are distinguishable, conceivable.
Right.
And unless they are, we can't use our logic to grasp them. So that's just as important as the ways in which things exhibit properties passively as well as actively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now we're talking about like philosophers and ideas that reduced aspects. So if I go back to historical, actually, and look at that, let's look at that real quick. Is there any philosopher who reduced the last one we talked about, the historical?
Who wanted to say this was the key to...
Yes.
Yes, in fact.
I mean, can I guess who it was? I'm going to guess. Okay, you guys think that I don't know this from 30 years ago, and I could be wrong, and I'm going to guess. I'm being vulnerable, everybody. I am being transparent. Hegel.
Not
history.
Oh, historical.
I went back one.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
So I'm backing up.
All right. He has the great all-encompassing mind.
Okay.
All right, which he calls God under some circumstances, and it includes everything.
Okay.
But the process by which it comes to self-realization, he says, is history. History, therefore, encompasses all reality.
So I got it right?
Yes.
Did you see that, everybody? I got this right. And you actually didn't think I was going to get it right. And I know you didn't think, but I got it right. So historical.
Well, there's another version of this present today. For epistemology, for our general theory of knowledge, there are a number of thinkers who argue that we create language. Language creates our experience, so we create our experience. So we're not finding things that are true independent of us. Give up that stuff about truth. We can't know
so
what's true.
So in terms of the back to linguistics now, the next one.
Okay.
So I got Hegel right on the historical one, now on linguistic.
Yeah, but that's the connection between the two.
Oh, so there's like this one plays with each other.
Have the formative power. One of the things we form is language.
Oh, okay.
So they're called historicists.
Oh.
So all the things that we believe are we have produced. We actually produce our own experience. Our experience is produced by our language. That's what allows us to think of things and speak of them the way we do.
From the past,
and we form
our
language. Therefore, we form our world.
So, in a sense, that group of people are a partnership between the historical aspect and the linguistic.
Yes, sure.
Okay,
sure.
So, what group is that again?
Well, modern pragmatism does that.
Oh.
Not to pick on anybody in particular, but his initials are Richard Rorty.
Richard Rorty, for one.
It says things just exactly like what I just described.
Hmm. Well, hold on then. So the linguistic, sometimes I have a hard time getting the idea of symbol, and then there's a whole question of nominalism and realism in words. I mean, okay, we're launching into this. I mean, bear with me. So we're launching into that. So nominalism, name, language, what it's called.
Yeah, well, that has to do with universals. It's an old problem and was raised even before Plato, but Plato's famous for his treatment of it.
Okay.
How does it come about that we can recognize this object, that object, the other object? Objects can only be in one place at one time. but they exhibit qualities that are in many places at once. What kind of a queer thing is that?
Yes,
there are many blue things. There are many square things.
Right.
And so on. And how do we recognize all the blue things as blue and so
right.
on? Now, his famous theory was there's another dimension to reality.
Right.
And in this other dimension,
there are
perfections.
Ah.
There's the perfect blue. There's the perfect square. There's the perfect chair. There's the perfect whatever. Mm-hmm. And all the stuff that we experience in this world mm-hmm. are imperfect copies of the perfections in Plato's great barnyard in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and he puts all of mathematics there.
Mm-hmm.
All the numbers, all the fractions, lines, points, triangles, and perfect circles.
Right.
Things we never see in mm-hmm. this world. There's never a perfect circle we can draw.
Right.
Then how do we get the idea? Well, our minds are in tune with this world of perfections.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are universals. That's
right.
his theory of universals.
Right.
What all the instances, when you use the same term for many for many individuals, you're naming a universal property, a property held by more than one thing at the same time.
Right.
And his answer to how that can happen is that they're all copying the perfect universe.
Right.
Model for what is green or red or square or whatever in this other world. A nominalist says, no. This other world is all ridiculous.
Okay.
Forget it. We do not ever experience the same property. Properties are just like things. They are individual. They're only in one place at one time. Nothing shares the same shade of blue.
Right.
No. Three. Four,
so this
two,
is
three,
very,
four
very relativistic.
So this
so there's the historical and the linguistics
the
and the
universal.
Relativism.
What's common to the many individuals that we talk about is only the linguistic name we give them. That's the only thing. That's where you get nomina, name.
Name.
So one of the early ones says the universal is nothing but the breath of a voice pronouncing a name. So we say blue. What do all the blue things have in common? Nothing in them that we call them all by the same name. That's
gotcha.
It. That's instead of Plato's other world. We, by the way, Dewey gives a very powerful critique of both those views.
Okay.
They're both eminently rejectable.
Why are they religious?
I didn't say they were religious. I said they were rejectable.
Well, rejectable, but I'm just coming down that religion.
Neither one of them will fly. In the early thinkers, like Plato not only wants there to be these universal exemplars in the other world that things in this world copy, but they're divine. They play a role that's partly a substitute for God.
Mm.
They're eternal, uncreated, changeless, and they have a great influence in making this world what it is.
Gotcha.
There's a world of space and matter in it that in Plato's ontology, but it would be total chaos unless the form world impressed itself, unless the world with the perfections and the laws and mathematics and all impressed order onto this world.
Gotcha.
And the only reason this world comes out to be imperfect copies of these things is the matter that you have to work with is so intrinsically imperfect, it can't perfectly reflect the universal. So the universal start out, and part of their role is religious.
Okay.
And Plato, when he called them forms, rather than universals, same thing, he calls them forms, and he says there is a highest one, a highest form. The form of what it is to be a form, I guess.
Right.
And he calls it the God and Father of all things. So
really?
He's not shy at all about the religious import of it.
Okay, so a term from my distant past just came back in my brain, and it's somehow in the category of Plato, the unmoved mover. Was that Plato?
That's Aristotle.
Oh, okay. I'm with the Greeks. Okay, don't judge me too quickly. You didn't even know that. Okay,
Plato's most famous student. Yeah, and for him,
is Aristotle.
Yeah, and for Aristotle, too, there is a huge difference between matter in space, which would be chaotic were it not for the orderliness of the mathematical truths, especially logical, that impress themselves there and bring about a cosmos rather than a chaos.
Right.
For Aristotle, that impression happens here. This is our world. And it's at the center of the universe, because it's the worst place in the universe, not the best.
Oh.
It's like the drain where all the the refuse goes, and every layer of the universe as we go out from Earth has more and more rationality, less and less matter, until finally you come to the realm that's inhabited only by thought thinking itself.
Oh,
the perfect the perfection, the logical perfection here.
Right.
And he calls that God. Okay. He also calls it the unmoved mover. What he means is it's changeless. And it brings about change, not by exercising an effect on a direct effect, the way we usually think of one thing
right.
producing change in another, but only because all of the things in this poorest part of reality,
right,
the poorest part of the universe, so strive to be like that. So without changing itself, it changes other things because they're attractive.
Now, one thing I noticed in the case, we talked about logical, historical, and linguistic, just the last three.
Yeah.
And when you're talking like this, you really see these connections all kind of working themselves out to be absolutizing. So you got Aristotle, there's logic, there's the history, there's the development, there's linguistic naming, and is it real, not real, Plato. All of it is fascinating how, though the Greeks were centuries ago, Dorie Weird sees aspects that other philosophers have reduced one aspect or another.
Yes, and what he, of course, what Dorie Weird wants to do is start philosophy on the basis of the knowledge we have of God in Christ.
Right.
And that means that all of the properties and laws that we find in creation, the kinds of properties and the laws that we find in creation have been created, called into being by God. None of them are God's uncreated, originating being.
Gotcha.
Okay. God transcends all of that because he brought all that into existence. God enters into his creation, however,
right.
and takes on these characteristics, takes them into himself, often eternally. I mean, it doesn't mean there's a time when God didn't have it and began to.
Right.
God never. There never was a time God wasn't wise. But Proverbs 8 says that wisdom is his creation.
Right. Even wisdom.
Even wisdom. So I think that's a model for the way to understand how God possesses his attributes. And I think that model I call an incarnational model.
Right.
In the same way as God took the person of Jesus Christ, who is a creation,
right.
a human being, into himself, so that Christ becomes the human side of God, God becomes the divine side of Christ.
Right.
So God took into himself characteristics of personality, for
right.
example, and be able to know things in the world and to react
right.
and interact with human beings. So rather than say, oh no, God just has perfections and that's it, and he doesn't really love anybody, he doesn't really get pissed off at anybody. No, he gets really angry, he really loves people, he grieves when they do evil, he rejoices when people repent. The scripture affirms all of that, and the people that identify God with the Platonic perfections say, no, he doesn't.
Mm-hmm. One more thing about linguistic that I find fascinating. Okay, so the internet, the World Wide Web, if you were to say, what is the sort of glue that holds Google together? It's the linguistic. It's the keywords. It's the relevant search for language that solves the problem, the information age. And these start becoming closer to who people are and how they operate with their smartphones and how they operate. So we have this beautiful language that's now becoming sophisticated, and now there's algorithms written about the words and how people. So a lot of this is relevant stuff
sure.
for today.
Sure.
And Dorie could not have dreamed how.
Yeah. Yeah.
An aspect like this could be so functionally relevant for
so
people
in,
today.
In his terminology, a smartphone is an artifact that we produce.
Yes.
It's made of natural materials. We form them
yes.
so that this is a formative product.
Yes.
And it's linguistically qualified
yes.
because that is its intrinsic purpose is
right.
to be able to
they
convey
talk to you now.
Convey language.
I can get my phone out and
yeah,
I can
that's
talk
right.
and they talk right back to you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
next one is social. Social interaction. Now, hold on a second. That's an aspect of reality. That's just something we do. How can
we do it in a specific way. This doesn't mean social in the thick sense that everything from here on is. This is the beginnings. Humans, once they have language, can interact socially in such a way that they have status. They have social position.
Okay.
Some people have authority. Some don't. So he points out that a house is a formative object that we create.
Right.
If it's more than just a hut or a lean-to, if it's actually got rooms, usually the rooms exhibit the social status of the people that use them. So the master bedroom is bigger.
Right, okay. And so in Western culture,
master bedroom is bigger. Well, I think it tends to be true in most cultures.
Parents, or the elders have status even in the architecture.
If you just have a tent, that doesn't apply. But the buildings themselves betray or exhibit this business of social ranking.
Right.
One of the chief properties that's a social property, I think, is respect.
Right.
And whether that's granted or it's denied, and people can get very upset about that kind of thing.
Yeah, what's rude and what's not rude.
That's right, rude, not rude.
People smart. We have that people smart class because we're putting you in tune with what is socially out there so that you do well as a leader.
Yeah. And there are standards of courtesy. We all know that those differ very much from place to place, but the point is people have them.
Right.
They're not without them. Wherever there are humans, there are such things.
I have a good story, I think, and see if it applies. If it doesn't, it's just a good story. Okay. So at one of the churches, actually the church with Dr. Fettes, we actually had a buggy driver at the local race track. Now, none of us are into gambling or anything like that, so I'm kind of on thin ice to tell the story, but I'll tell it anyway. Okay. So that was his job, and then he and his wife became no Lord. But he's been at that for 20, 30 years, riding his little buggies. And so I was talking to him one time, and we were talking about their horses.
Mm-hmm.
So he was talking about this horse and everything, and then he said, well, that one went Amish. And then you talk about this one and whatnot, and then that one went Amish. So I thought, what, Amish? Like, how does the horses go Amish? Well, he said, Brother Joseph wants to have a faster horse than Brother Henry. So what they do is they come to the racetrack and buy the horses.
The faster horse.
The faster horse. They pay cash. In fact, they're some of the best buyers of the horses.
Right.
So the social connection between Brother Joseph, Brother Roy, and Brother Henry is, we would both want a horse that's just a little faster than the next guy. And these are in Amish. They don't have cars.
Right.
But they want, if they're going to have one horse,
then
they want
to be the fastest horse.
Okay. That's sort of what we're talking about.
Sure.
It's like, we have a social, there's rules in that social, laws within the social, laws within social classes.
Well, and speak of the Amish, they have it in spades. I mean, they have their protocols, and if you violate it, nobody will talk to you. That's the first punishment, that you're shunned.
Right.
And that's a social stigma to be shunned. Yeah.
Well, now, many of you are entering ministry, and you've come out of a certain strata, and you're here doing bivocational ministry, and as you lead people, you'll come with various a diversity of people that will come and follow because the whole world needs Christ. What did you say at dinner about Luther? He said something about a lion or a cat or something like that.
Yes, he said the gospel doesn't need to be defended. It's like a lion. It just needs to be let loose.
It just needs to be let loose. So you are going to let the gospel loose, but as the gospel goes forward, you will find that many people that are not even in your social class will start coming and making a connection to you because the gospel has changed their life. So, and it's important that the social understanding is within us as leaders.
Yes, and of course the Christian understanding of that is that there are definite limits to this idea of social prestige and how much should give accord to that. What's praised in Scripture is that people do not regard someone else's social status and treat them all alike, and the insistence that the church do that.
Right.
So you're not kissing up to somebody just because they're wealthy or they
have a title. You're not getting
people
smart in ministry to manipulate them.
Yeah.
It's to serve everyone the same.
That's right. That's right.
Is there anybody that reduced the social aspect that you can think of?
Well, there's no one that said all reality is social or all knowledge is founded there. No, I don't know of that.
So this is just everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's amazing, isn't it? I'm just thinking Jesus gives this one illustration. He says one time to his disciples, when you go to a feast, where do you look to see the most important people? You look at the head table. No, it's the waitress because she's serving people.
That's
pretty radical.
Okay, so sociology. Is sociology social?
Sociology, as that term is used for the discipline, includes a great deal more than the social.
Yes.
All right. So that we should be clear. It kind of has its home ground there. It starts there.
Yeah, yeah.
But almost immediately it goes to relations between the social and other aspects of our society. It goes to considering issues in the law or in ethics or in art, and these are all other aspects. So generally speaking, as people who call themselves sociologists are concerned with these basic social issues, mm-hmm. but then applying them elsewhere. It's not restricted to society.
Right. But yeah, I bring that up because sociology is a science of the study of the social.
Yeah. But it almost has no delimitations as it's practiced.
Oh, I see. So it was like anything to do with human interaction is studied. Okay. Economic. The frugal use of resources. So this is not just business here. This is an economic...
That's right. It's how things exhibit economic worth. And that something has to be scarce to be economically valuable.
Okay.
So if air is plentiful for everybody and nobody gets charged for clean air yet, then it's not worth anything. Nobody will pay for it.
Right.
But if a resource is limited, as people used to think, things such as gold and diamonds are very limited, and therefore they're
rare gems.
Therefore, the price goes up.
Right.
And what Dewey's emphasis is here is to see that the principles of economics, the law of supply and demand, diminishing returns, and the like, apply to everything in creation.
Right.
Everything has an economic side to it. So a church is not a business. It's not there to make a profit, but it has a business side to it.
Yes.
So does a state. So does a family. A business is right there and plunked in the middle of the economic. They're there to make a service or a product that they can sell and provide a living for their employees and make a profit.
You know, a lot of families don't see how the economic relates there. We have some classes on life skills. Enterprise 101, Dr. Fettes has been working on a class that will be on soon. Maybe by the time you see this down the road, that class will already be up about life skills. And a lot of it refers to the frugal use not only of money, but of time and of space. There's a lot to successfully living in the world. And the economic is not just reduced to money.
No. That's right.
What about an absolutizer? Who absolutized the economic? I'm guessing it's Marx, but you know.
Actually, Marx is a materialist.
Oh,
okay.
He
calls himself a dialectical materialist. Marx's position is roughly: there is matter; matter is ultimate. It's uncreated.
Okay.
It's the metaphysically ultimate reality.
But he talks about people who have more and people who have less.
Yeah. But matter has within it an intrinsic law of development.
Okay.
This is the dialectical.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay.
And so, the dialectical.
Yeah.
Write that down. And that could be a quiz question. Okay, go ahead.
So there's one principle, it evokes its opposite. They come in conflict and they produce something new. These then split apart, do the same thing. Okay, that's rough, but that until you get living things and then you get humans. And now humans. are to be understood as beings that are what they are because of what they do for a living. What qualifies a human being is his work.
Gotcha.
So work and the economic exchange of the work for money or for goods characterizes all of human society. And his claim is that whatever form the human society takes in the forms of work and exchange of goods determines the kind of society you get and the beliefs the people will hold. So all beliefs from social on are the products of the economic system in which they arise.
Ah.
So it's, in that way, it's determined.
How resources are dispersed in a culture.
Determine what people believe.
Who, right.
But, and he thought that there was no fixed human nature.
Right.
So that if you got the right kind of society in which everybody shared everything and they didn't compete for economic goods, the whole idea of private ownership would just disappear in a generation or so, because people are infinitely malleable. If we can remake people to be good communist people, where they just naturally share everything rather than competing to have more.
Right. And so his belief was in the goodness of humanity.
It's not so much the goodness as because you can be corrupted by a capitalist society and then want more and more and more and more.
Then you're
the evil guy. So.
Right.
So it's deterministic.
Ah.
These are the causes. It all comes from matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But once you get
matter is the highest.
So that's the divine reality.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
the
one, the self-existent that generates everything else.
Yeah.
But for the explanation of human life, as soon as you come to social and economic, you get a society. You have exchange of goods by means of work.
Right.
And then one stage that can't help but going through is owners and workers.
Right.
But then that's got to be overcome, because that's way inferior to just not competing with each other, sharing all the goods, and everybody's happy.
Right.
And it really was that idealistic.
Unrealistic utopian, we call it sometimes.
Yeah, that's
now,
right.
On the economic, there's a lot of ways to think about this. In ministry, you by vocation, you must have the frugal use of resources to be able to even do ministry. If you're doing web marketing, nowadays they have they give you analytics so that you can frugally use the resources to know if your site is even relevant, is even getting hit or interested in, too. So, you know, this, you think about what Dory Ware did, it has not just philosophic ramifications, but as we're talking about through these presentations, there's so many meaning moments. I go, whoa. You know, one of the things that my father was Dutch, and everything about being raised with the frugal use of resources and moderation, and that's West Michigan, Dutch, where we live, and that it's fascinating. One fruit of that is that it's a very prosperous people. The second most affluent people in the United States are in this area, and they give to the kingdom, and we're grateful for that. But I will tell you that most of them considered themselves poor their entire life because of that frugal, I'm going to pinch a penny. But it actually, there's a good side to that. Of course, you can overdo that. Anything could be overdone.
So even the Vanderbilts thought they were poor?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about them. You know, they might have been American Dutch. I don't know. You know. Okay, so this one, how do you pronounce that?
Justicial.
Juridical.
That term. This has to do with justice. It has to do with the fact that once we get a society, we are exchanging goods and so on, the whole matter of what's fair in dealing with other people comes really to the fore and exerts its force in human life and thinking and society. So we do experience some things as fair and just and others as outrageously unfair and unjust.
Right.
And so this is what leads to the establishment of the state as an institution.
Right.
There's confusion. In the United States, we call the divisions of the national state states, so it's confusing.
Right.
But the traditional term for the political institution is the state, and the government is the ruling body in the state.
Ah.
Okay, so now what's the nature of the state? Well, when we analyze this
aspect, pursuit of happiness and liberty.
It's to establish an order of public justice.
Right.
Is way do we put it.
Okay, but now Jefferson kind of picked up on, the purpose of the state and rights.
He says the purpose of government is to pass laws to protect rights.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in knows that.
Yeah. Okay. We have. He says it's self-evident that people.
Self-evident.
All men are created equal, and they have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that it's to.
Would you have a problem with that?
Secure. Yeah, I do.
Here we go. Okay, so you Africans out there who are watching this, we have a little bit of debate here about Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers.
Well, Jefferson takes Christian ideas and he flips them. He turns them upside down from the way they had been believed for centuries.
Okay.
The Christian position wasn't people are born with rights sticking in them like feathers in an eagle. It's that God had built laws in the creation, such as the principle, be just to others, be loving to others, but particularly now we're talking about the justice, to treat one another fairly and justly.
Right.
Okay. And that's what gives us rights. Because the laws are God's laws and they govern all of reality, we have the right to be treated justly by other people because they have the obligation to be just to me as I do to them. So it's not that the rights are first and we make the laws to protect them. It's that the laws are already there and we're born under them. And that's why we have rights. And if you think that's a silly
distinction. I mean, I feel sort of it is. I can't quite see that big of a difference.
But here's the difference. If it's the laws that are primary and the rights are the result, then you cannot sensibly argue over who has rights and who doesn't. Everybody will, because laws are universal. They govern the whole creation.
Oh, so we're there all are no our debates. All our debates.
So you can't have a society in which you say Indians don't have any rights, blacks don't have any rights, women don't have any rights.
So we're arguing all these groups that have rights because it says we all have rights. But really, if the law said that all are treated fairly, and this everyone has rights, in the word all.
Yeah, I there's a line in my first book when I'm explaining this, and I said, so this means that the Christian view of government is that government should not favor Christians or anybody else. Government is to be as even-handed in its treatment of all its citizens as it can possibly be.
That's public justice.
Yes, public justice.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Has anybody absolutized this aspect?
No. I mean, there are people that have emphasized its importance. That starts even with Aristotle, Plato and Aristotle.
Right.
Aristotle says justice is the bond that binds men into states.
Okay.
And elsewhere he calls humans a political animal, meaning someone whose concern is justice and wants to see that enforced. So it means that you're safe in your person and your possessions and your family and so on.
Okay, the aesthetic. We're almost done here. Harmony, surprise, fun. What is that about?
That's still controversial.
Okay.
A lot of people think the aesthetic has to do with what is beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think what is beautiful is part of it, but it doesn't characterize the whole aspect.
Right.
And Dooyeweerd thinks that too. It doesn't do that.
Right.
We often are fascinated by something like a gargoyle, but it's not beautiful.
Right.
Or to be a little more gruesome, an accident site can be fascinating. We just can't take our eyes off it, even though it's also disgusting.
Yeah.
Okay. So other of his followers have proposed other things. Dooyeweerd said it was harmony.
Okay.
But I don't know how harmonious a gargoyle is.
Right.
Or harmonious with what?
Is that really just like a creative one? Like
no,
like
we have an aesthetic sense.
Okay.
And it's like it's exhibited.
We see things beautiful. We think things noticed.
Yeah.
I always say that a great Facebook ad has to be noticed, and it can be noticed in a lot of dimensions, from beauty to emotion. But there's something, if it's not, people won't even click it.
Yeah. But, well, this includes beauty. It has to be more than that. So I tried one time, I wrote a little essay, and I proposed that the central meaning of this was what we enjoy, enjoyment, which is not just a feeling, because when I look at the accident, I can feel repulsed. But in a sense, I still enjoy looking at it.
I see.
And in that way, it will also include not only the fine arts, but sports.
Right.
Why do we like to go to a ball game? We enjoy seeing people compete and show us spectacular athletic ability.
Would this also be like in the area of like story, a good book?
Oh, sure.
That like, you know, story would like often takes us out of our world. And we talk a lot of times. I mean, interesting speakers have the metaphors and the stories, and they're interesting to listen to, like you are. I have had you in my life for almost 2 weeks now, and it's like you're interesting because you see the creative side and the story and the,
well, thank you.
I'm just saying that really in all of life has that aspect.
Yes, everything has potentially an aesthetic value one way or another. Now, we call something a work of art when that piece, whatever it is, a piece of music, a painting, or what, is actually qualified by, this is in New Age terms, the aesthetic aspect. That's the one in which it functions. It's the highest one in which it functions, and so on. It gives away more of, that's a key to its nature.
Gotcha.
So you take a piece of stone, and whatever aesthetic value it has is very limited.
Right.
And then you carve a beautiful statue out of it, and it... Everybody says, wow, there's
Michelangelo.
Sure, Michelangelo's David,
Okay, so then ethical. You wrote the ethical aspect as the term is used here to do with norms concerning what is loving or beneficent.
Beneficent. Okay, that's better than self-giving. It doesn't mean just self-giving love. That's the kind of love that the New Testament describes God as having for us.
Oh, okay.
But the commandment here about this as an aspect of our life is more follows the second commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now that includes yourself.
Right.
See? So it's not just self-giving. It's not just altruistic. I'm not to sacrifice all of my own good for somebody else.
Yeah, well, we wrote down that from Wikipedia, so that might be a Wikipedia.
Wikipedia needs corrected there. Yeah,
okay.
So I love my neighbor as I do myself. There's nothing wrong with loving myself. And I balance my good with my neighbor's.
Right.
If I can give up something that's relatively minor to me and a great benefit to my neighbor, that's something I should do.
Right.
When it gets a lot closer, maybe I'm not quite sure what to do here.
Right.
Or if it's the reverse, I would have to suffer greatly in order to give my neighbor something very insignificant. I don't have any obligation to do that at all. I'm to love my neighbor as myself.
Right.
It's a powerful
rule. So you're really saying like there's a certain difference between self-interested and selfish.
Yes, that's right.
You know, to be self-interested means you're an image bearer of God. You have rights, you have responsibilities.
Yeah.
You live your life, but ultimately is to provide love for my neighbor as I love myself.
Yeah. Now, one of the confusions, I should mention this before we leave. In the United States, there's a confusion of terminology that causes no end of messiness.
Okay.
And that is that when we are discussing the law,
right.
Not ethics, but the law, but justice. It's a common terminology in the law to talk about things that are unjust, but no one has made a law against them as morally wrong. Now, what we should say is they're juridically, or with respect to justice, they're unjust, and there ought to be a law, but they call it morality.
Right.
And that confuses the juridical sense of of this with the moral sense. The strictly moral sense we take
confusion there.
We take to be from the second commandment, of the first, the two great commandments, to love God unlimitedly. That's all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, where our whole being is dedicated to God. No balance. But with my neighbor, there's a balance. And so it has to do with love and hate.
Right.
So why is it an aspect of everything? Easy. It's not just people we can love and hate. I had a suit I bought 40 years ago. I thought it was really smart. I love that suit. Or somebody says, you know, I bought one of those cars. I hate that piece of junk. From the day I got it, it gave me nothing but trouble. So it has to do with things as objects of love and hate, with our obligation.
It can be passive, it can be active. Yeah. It can be, you know, for a Christian, bitterness sets in when hate goes deeper and the lack of forgiveness. So, I mean, it even becomes into the religious sphere of our lives.
Sure.
Critical.
Yes.
So one more, the last one, the fiduciary and the pistic.
Okay.
You wrote, by the way, I'll tell you what you wrote.
What's it?
This is what you wrote. Faith, vision, commitment, beliefs, trustworthiness. Okay. The term fiduciary is used to refer to the varying levels of reliability or trustworthiness a thing or a person may have. This aspect is especially important in connection with human social relations, with human social relations of all sorts, which disintegrates rapidly where there is significant lack of trust.
Right. So this is an aspect of everything too. Things are trustworthy in many different respects. We usually single one main one out at a time, but sometimes not. Sometimes we want something to be trustworthy in this way, and this way, and so on, but we make judgments about that. Now, this has a special relation to theology,
right?
Because what it is that people trust most, that is the thing they think is the most trustworthy, it cannot fail, it always turns out to be what they regard as divine.
Right.
And that's the self-existent reality that generates everything else.
Right.
So what they put their most trust in has a correspondence to theology, where we try to explain the divinity belief of a person and its ramifications.
Right, so there's almost a science aspect to this, that we study the science of the knowledge of God here in this area. I mean, you know, in a sense, a lot, we talk about science and the earlier ones. And
I think it would be more careful to say it's an investigation. All right. If you want to use science, right?
It's a dangerous thing. Hey, this is, you know, I'm just like you. I'm just trying to make sense out of this.
Okay. Thomas Aquinas called theology the science of God.
Okay.
Okay. The Orthodox and Calvinist traditions find that outrageous.
Okay. So
make God an object of investigation. The object of investigation is His Word.
Right.
Not God. And we do try to take that apart and to the best of our ability, understand exactly what it's saying there, what teaching we can get from
right.
It. But it, the fiduciary at large is an aspect of all things.
I got you.
So,
not just God.
My car would make a very poor paperweight.
I got it. Okay.
It's too big. but then my little bronze medallion with a picture of a president on it makes a very nice paperweight.
Got it.
So some things are good for
like
some.
When they fit a situation, when they're appropriate, when they're trustworthy, because that's the appropriate remedy to a problem.
Yeah.
That's also part of the fiduciary.
Yeah. And some people have suggested that the science of this, short of theology, short of the most trustworthy of all,
right,
which is unconditionally trustworthy,
right,
in all the other respects, would be probability.
Okay.
What's the probability that this will
bring blessings,
stand up for the purpose that I'm trying to use it?
Yeah. Gotcha. It's like purpose, even a little purpose.
Sure.
In there too.
Oh, sure.
Right. Well, good. Okay. So there you have it. The aspects of Christian philosophy from Hermann Doyward, and I enjoyed this. I want to thank you for...
My pleasure.
You know, I wanted to always have this discussion with a real Christian philosopher 30 or 35 years after I studied this, and I'm amazed at how much I remembered. So, you know, and I had my holes. You saw...
That's good.
That I had my issues.
That's right.
You know, and we have issues. I have my issues. But this is just a wonderful thing that can be in your life, and it will start shaping your thought and your ministry, or if you have a business, all of these things. So again, I just thank you for the time that you shared, and we'll see what God is going to do with this kind of insight.
Amen.